Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mel, and I'm here with my co-host, Jack Korzenowski.
Ahoy there, y'all.
Jack, what it is?
Some say it don't be like it is, but it do. I don't know
but
if that's the official quote. I found out through, like, I looked that up once, not here on the show, but I thought it was like some weird quote from a movie or something. It's like, nope, some guy actually said that one time. It was like, I think he was a baseball player back in the 80s or 90s.
It wasn't Yogi Berra, was it?
No. It was some guy I never heard of.
Oh, he was the one who was notorious for having, like, almost nonsensical quotes.
Oh, okay.
Like, baseball's 90% mental, the other half is physical. Which, I think, on its face, some people are like, oh, he doesn't know how to do math. But then it's like, or was he trying to make a point that it takes a lot of work?
Right. It's over 110%.
Also, interesting question that just came to mind because I was looking at our list of episodes in the season.
Mm-hmm.
How do we, in the past, we've kind of broken up seasons because we had breaks or like there was some natural pause for some reason. How do we decide when the third season is over?
Well, do we need to have seasons in the first place?
I mean, it's kind of a norm.
Is it? I mean, all the podcasts that I listen to, which is two, excluding ours, and three if you count a podcast that I used to listen to and is now defunct, didn't have seasons. It was just, you know, episode whatever. Do most podcasts have seasons?
I mean, it seems like yes. Like when I publish an episode, it has fields for season number and episode number.
Well, maybe that's there in case we want to have seasons, but I mean, is it so obnoxious? Is it so ridiculous to say, well, we don't really have seasons? Because we don't, right? I mean, the whole nature of the show is we get on, we just chat about most random of topics. And I think that the concept of a season implies that there's some sort of a break or a transition between we were doing something last season, now we're doing something new.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of goes against, you know, how we do things here. So I don't know, maybe it's time to question whether we need seasons at all. Just, I mean, for our podcast, not so much for podcasts in general. Although for all those podcasters that do arbitrarily put seasons onto their episodes, you know who you are.
I think it's just a lot of people have other stuff that they do, right? So maybe they take a break in the summer because their kids are off for school, or maybe they only do a podcast in the summer because that's when they're off of work and so they've got time to do it or whatever. I think there's reasonable explanations for why you might, but certainly not a requirement.
But even then, right, I never listen to podcasts as they like come out. Like I'm never like, oh, every week I got to catch this podcast on Monday or whatever. It's like I pick a podcast that has a big backlog and I just listen through it one after the other. And as soon as I reach the end, then it's like, okay, then move on to another one or maybe even restart it if it's long enough and interesting enough and deep enough. So like if somebody listens, because even if you are only releasing podcasts for a short chunk of time or a defined chunk of time every, let's say, year, right? 3 months out of the year or 9 months out of the year. And then there is that natural break as far as the scheduling goes. If you're just listening to it front to back, binging it, you aren't necessarily going to know that there was a big time jump between this episode and the last one, unless there is some distinct difference in how they do things, what they're doing, maybe who is on podcasts, things like that. And for us, I would think that transition or that jump, right? We could go 1 week between episodes, or we can go 1 year, and the listener, unless we draw attention to it, isn't going to know the difference.
Yeah, and I mean, we don't really talk about episodes or season. We don't talk about seasons within the episodes. It's just in the title. So it's not like it's tied to the content at all. And it doesn't build from one episode to the next either, or one season to the next. So we do have, we've got 21 episodes from the first two seasons. We've got 21 episodes so far in season three. So maybe episode 43, we just transition out of seasons and do the overall episode count.
Mm.
Episode 43. Why even have episodes, though? We could just have installments.
Ooh. What could another moniker be other than episode?
Chunks? Bits?
Ooh, bits would be good. I was going to say chapters, but yeah. Ramblings?
This is
ram or tangents. We could call them tangents, Ben.
Tangent 43.
Yeah, tangent 43. Ooh. I like that.
Something. All right, I'm down. Decision made. Tangent 43.
Yes. Yes.
Although we've had far more than 43 tangents over the course of the show.
That's true.
Give each episode can be have a primary tangent.
Or, you know, you maybe somewhat sarcastically said, why even have episodes? Maybe we can even keep, and this is totally not, I don't think, worth it. But it's an interesting concept where, like, let's say this episode, we have three separate tangents, right? So then we can call it not episode whatever, but we call it tangents X plus one and X plus two. And then the next time, if we have four tangents, then it's, you know, X plus three plus, you know, four, like basically keeping count in the episodes. And we don't actually, we record in individual episodes, but we keep track of our progress by how many tangents we've had.
Ooh, but that raises the question of what qualifies as a tangent. Can you just make an aside, like a single comment? Does that count as a tangent? Or does it have to be a thread of conversation? How long does it have to last?
That's a good question. If it's an aside, so I think a clear indicator of what is a tangent is if we never go back to the subject that we veered off from. That's an obvious tangent. What isn't so obvious is, okay, we veered off of topic one onto topic two onto topic three. Do we eventually veer back to topic one? And if so, okay, were topics two and three tangents, or were they just sort of asides? I mean, we'd really have to, it would be quite the subjective call, I think.
Well, and I would argue that if you never come back to your original topic, then it wasn't a tangent at all. It was actually the primary thread of the conversation.
Perhaps, but it originated, or it was still a tangent. It may have just been a really big one.
It left the previous discussion incomplete.
Right. And I think that's I would say as far as discussions go, that is the topic of a tangent, or the idea of a tangent, where you're talking about one thing and eventually start veering further and further off until eventually you're on a whole new topic. I guess the question of do you return to your original topic or not, you know, you could have a tangent that does or doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the call of is this a tangent or not comes to the call. What you're really asking is, okay, is this a different conversation? Like if somebody, said, hey, I'm going to step away for a few minutes. I'll be right back. And then they come back and the conversation is completely unrecognizable. You know, that I would consider a tangent. Whether or not they eventually came back almost doesn't matter. You know, later on, if they eventually go back to topic, almost doesn't matter. But what I was, my hesitation there is, even if they come back and the conversation isn't recognizable, it still could be in an applicable side conversation that you are only trying to resolve because of its relevance to the first topic. And that's not, I would not consider that a tangent. You're just discussing one specific nuance of the previous topic.
So I think this would be a good opportunity for some feedback from listeners. If you have a good set of criteria for what makes a tangent, and you want to volunteer to listen through our existing episodes and tell us how many tangents we've had up until this point based on those criteria, apply within.
You will not be compensated for your time.
And neither will we. Congratulations.
We're compensated by their viewership.
I mean, depends on how loose your definition of compensation is.
Well, I just said we are, by inputting our work, what we get back is the viewership of our audience. So the compensation is itself the fact that, hey, we have views or listens.
Right. Which, I mean, to be considered compensation, there has to be worth in that thing, right?
Not necessarily. I would say not necessarily, right? You could say I'm compensating somebody for, like, you know, helping me build a fence. I'm compensating them with, I don't know, I'm giving them an old pair of sneakers or something. And
like a white elephant.
Yeah, giving them a broken radio. I did that once for a white elephant gift. I had this broken iHome radio from like the early 2000s, and I brought that. I was pretty proud of myself because I was literally just dumping my trash on somebody else and calling it a party.
See, my problem is when I have something like that, it's like I would rather have it out of my house sooner. So I never think to keep something around for that. Or like when I go scrounging, it's just super boring stuff.
Well, so let me qualify that a little bit. It still worked. It just didn't work very well. So, and I was just too lazy to get it replaced. But then when I heard the White Elephant gift exchange, I was like, you know what? This is a good opportunity for me to get a new radio. So that's how it came to be.
Sure. Have you ever had one of the little hand crank survival radios?
No.
I feel like that would be a great white elephant. One of those that's like 30 years old. Or a hand crank. We used to have hand crank flashlights.
I have heard of those.
It was kind of cool. It had like a little spring-loaded grip. Almost like one of those grip strength building squeeze handle things.
Yeah.
But then as you squeezed it, it would spin a magnet and generate electricity, and then you just keep pumping it, and then you get more electricity for your flashlight.
Oh, cool. How long would it kind of stay, you know, full on?
That's pretty neat.
How long would it stay like full power until it started to noticeably dwindle?
It wasn't, if my memory serves, it wasn't much more than when you stopped pumping the handle. But I think that was just because of the design of it. Like, I don't think it really included a battery. I think it was just the motor itself, essentially.
Oh, so you had to keep spinning it in order for it to have voltage.
Right, yeah. You couldn't, like, charge it up. But you could like, it would change the intensity of the light based on how active or vigorous you were with the charging.
Interesting.
So, I think version 2 or a more expensive version probably could have included a battery so you could, you know, charge it up and then use it without pumping it when you actually need to hold it. Like, the problem was, when it only works as you're pumping, you can't really point it at something directly because your hand is moving. So.
Right. It'd be pretty shaky. Yeah, if it had some sort of battery, then that'd be really nifty. Because then you could just pump it for a while, charge it up, and then you have steady light for a while. But alas, mm-hmm. I guess that was out of scope or something for the designers.
Speaking of, I feel like I should get a stationary bike, hook that up to the house circuit. So if we ever lose power, you could have a little backup power from the stationary bike.
And you get your exercise in.
Yeah. Like, all right, you want lights today? You better get downstairs. Go pedal that bike. Sounds like something a dad would say.
Do you know how much horsepower it takes to, well, yeah, how much horsepower does it take to, like, if you just, like, kind of left your house running, like, as far as electricity, just kept it running like normal, like you're not trying to ration electricity because you're running off a generator. How much horsepower would that take?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand. I think an average house is probably in the, like, 2-3 kilowatt, or not kilowatt, megawatt hours per month range.
Okay.
But I don't remember any of the conversions there.
I want to say it's like 700. It's more than 100, but less than 1,000 watts per horsepower. So one horsepower is less than, but pretty close to, like, it's less than one order of magnitude off from a kilowatt.
Yeah, I think so. One horsepower is like either 0.7 or 0.75 kilowatts.
Okay. So then, yeah, so then there's 700 to 750 watts per horsepower. Okay. And I asked that because I can't remember where I learned it. It was a while ago. It may have been in preparation for my bike trip, that your average, like, person can output a third of a horsepower on a bike. Like, sustainably. You can just sit there and bike at a third of a horsepower, I believe.
Does that seem reasonable? Because I want to say, like competitive cyclists are in the 400 to 500 watts range, and I guess that might be right. And a typical person would be about like 200 watts, maybe.
So I heard the figures I got were like your average person can do a third. And then, like, but like your average cycling athlete, like a professional cyclist, could do like a half sustained. And I can't remember if it was sustained or like if they're going as hard as they could. But I thought,
yeah, I feel like that's probably pretty high.
A third?
Like it'd be closer to like in running, we called it your threshold pace, like. Basically, what's the fastest you could run without your pace dropping off? I think someone riding at half of a horsepower would, or however many watts that works out to, would be not sustainable indefinitely. Like, that would be a fairly high output intensity. Mm. Okay, with that premise, if you've got, let's just take a round number and say you've got 2 megawatt hours of electrical usage in a month. I'll just keep it simple, not counting in gas or anything else, but 2 megawatt hours of electrical usage in a month. What would that work out to? It's going to be like 2,600 horsepower hours.
Horsepower hours. Well, 2 million watts divided by, let's say, 30 days. We'll make it short. That's 66, about 67 kilowatts. 200, two, so it was 2 million or so 2 million watt hours per month equates to 67,000 watt hours per day. And if you can do 200 watts, you're going to need a bike 333 hours a day.
So if my math is right, it's about 3.5 horsepower consistent.
Okay. Which makes sense, because if that is, would you say 33 1/3? 33.5?
What?
What? How much horsepower? 33.5.
No, 3.5. 3.5.
Oh, sorry, 3.5. That is roughly 1, 2, 3. That's roughly 10 to 11 times 1/3 of a horsepower, which is your average, or the average that I had for how much horsepower a person can just sustainably generate on a bike. So it's going to require 10 times the amount of power. Now, my estimate were 2 million. If you use 200 watts, then it's about 15-ish, 16-ish times. So around there, so anywhere between, 5 to 20. You need 5 to 20 people biking, but at like a comfortable rate, a rate where they could do it indefinitely. They're not really working that hard to power a house.
Or another way to say that is if you were pedaling at your maximum 24/7, you could turn your power on for like 1 hour and 40 minutes a day.
Yikes.
For normal usage. Sounds like a pretty sweet bargain to me.
The amount
Although,
of food
how much,
that you would have to eat to maintain that.
And how much additional power are you going to need for the cooling after
right.
the waste heat you dump into the air? Honestly, probably not that much compared to the thermal energy hitting the house.
Oh, yeah.
All things considered. Okay, well, that was an interesting tangent, but we haven't even introduced our topic.
Count it. Chalk it up on the big board. One more tangent down.
One more tangent. Hashtag one more tangent. You saying big board made me think of episode of Always Sunny where Charlie's talking about the mailroom guy.
Pepe Sylvia?
Pepe Sylvia. Yeah, Pepe Sylvia.
Charlie, let me stop you right there. Not only do all of these people exist, but they have been asking for their mail on a daily basis.
That is like... Well, I feel like one of the most classic episodes of that show.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Okay, so anyway, the topic for today was something that you thought of, I think, following our last conversation. So you want to introduce that topic for us?
Yeah, it came up, I believe it was in our last episode with Mr. Kabud. And it's just the simple question of why are people afraid to say no? In any context, or I should say in most contexts. This isn't about any particular context. It could be at work. It could be if somebody says, hey,
no.
If somebody says, hey, do you want to, like, I'm going to this, you want to come with me? Or, like, particularly if they're asking in person. It could be, why are people so afraid to say no? Or like when you're at the like store and they ask, are you part of our rewards program? Oh, I'm not. Would you like to join? A lot of people say, sure.
No.
I actually have a funny anecdote about that. So I was, and I think this speaks to why people are afraid to say no. I went to Barnes & Noble maybe month and a half ago, and I got a handful of books. And I don't usually go to Barnes & Noble, I don't regularly go to Barnes & Noble. It's a pretty irregular affair. So when the person asked, hey, are you part of our rewards program? I said, nope. They said, would you like to join? You get like this many dollars off today. And then here's the other benefits. I said, no, thank you. And he said, really, you're sure? I was like, yep. And he was like, you're saying no to free money? Yep. And he gave me this look. And he's like,
Yeah.
okay. And then, yeah, like just went along with the purchase. And I think from that experience, one of the reasons why people are afraid to say no is because they're assuming that if they're asked a question like, can you do this for me, or do you want to be a part of this, or what have you, and they say no, the person asking is going to keep pushing them and berating them. And the person who's like, I don't have, like, I don't, I just, I'm not up for it, I'll just say yes to get them off my back. And that's why people are not in every situation, but I think that would probably account for a fair bit of the instances, the population of instances where people are afraid to say no. What do you have any thoughts?
So many thoughts.
Oh, play them on us.
I've also, specific to
Wait,
Barnes and
Ben.
Noble, wait,
Ben, hold
what?
on.
No,
How
I'm gonna
many
continue.
would you say? 10 million?
No, probably not 10 million. I'm gonna start with a specific example of Barnes and Noble because I used to be a rewards member there, and I have gone so infrequently over the past few years that like my rewards membership keeps lapsing or something, which they're one of the few organizations that I know of where like if you don't use your rewards membership, it expires. A lot of places will your points will expire or whatever rewards you get, but theirs, your actual membership expires. And I've never quite understood that. I think they just want you to pay up whatever it is, 10 bucks or something for your membership. But yeah, I've gotten to a point where it's like I'm just gonna ignore it because I don't use it enough to be worthwhile. But it's also crazy how I'll say it this way, rewards have become ubiquitous. Like there's rewards for everything. And it's crazy how pushy some of the organizations are. Like TJ Maxx is the one that always gets me. I really love shopping there in terms of what they carry and the deals that you can get. But then it's like every time I check out, like, oh, do you want to join our rewards program or a loyalty program or whatever? It's like, no, I don't. I come in here a couple times a year and I don't need any kind of a loyalty program for that. But it also makes me wish that we had, because they're so distributed, it's like streaming services or frequent flyer miles, like to really get value out of it, you've got to have a bunch, but you want to kind of focus on a key, like what's the one that you go to most often. I wish there was like an exchange, like a stock exchange only for rewards from different companies where you're like, sure, I'm in this rewards program for Barnes and Noble, but I'm there once a year. So who wants Barnes and Noble rewards? And then I can get your, Quickstar rewards or whatever.
Ooh,
It'd be pretty neat.
I do have an aside, and we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but I think the rewards or the exchange system would defeat the purpose of rewards. And actually, because the reason why why companies offer you rewards is to incentivize you to buy
Right.
more. But if you're like, I'm not going to use these rewards. One, you're admitting that the benefits of the rewards, as far as from the company's perspective, no longer there. And all any more purchases, whether they're from you or the person exchanging rewards for yours, they weren't necessarily not, or excuse me, they weren't necessarily they were already looking to buy from that place anyway. That's why they're willing to trade rewards for yours. And so the company, all that's happening with the company is they're losing money that they would have gotten anyway.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I see rewards as kind of like it's intended to gain money over the long run by spending money to retain customers, essentially. Right? So a place that offers rewards, more or less by its nature, is going to have higher prices to offset that cost that they're using on rewards. But the other thing is, like so many places, rewards or loyalty programs are like, I don't know what the utilization rate is, but it seems like they only ever offer garbage, essentially. It's like, oh, here's a tote bag or a what's it, you know? It's just like, this isn't useful or meaningful. So why, you know, they're trying to do as little as possible to invest in the loyalty element of it. Versus, I think there are some places that do really prioritize their rewards or loyalty programs. And certainly I would say those tend to be the more like premium brands, like REI, for example, I think is a business that has a really strong membership program, where if you're looking for premium brands in camping or outdoor equipment or whatever, they're going to give you pretty good deals because it's expensive to begin with.
When you say strong membership program, do you mean like a membership program that's, oh wow, this is the real deal. I would actually consider getting this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember what I think. If you have a membership, you can get like a lifetime membership for $50 or something like that. And then members get, I can't remember what it is. I want to say you can get like 10% off or something like that. And they also do like special members only sales and things like that. So you can go buy something. Like they'll literally have, I mean, it'd be kind of like, I guess, Sam's Club or something like that, where it's, you're getting a value because you're a member that somebody else wouldn't get.
Okay.
And it's on stuff that you want to buy anyway. So it's not like they're discounting some other random thing that you weren't even going to get. You know what I mean?
I think so.
Like the gas stations that do the, oh, if you buy, you know, whatever, $20 worth of something, we'll give you 5 cents a gallon off of gas. It's
Ah, I
just
see.
like,
Thanks.
it's like, wait, when you do the math on that, it does not help you.
No, but you would like really, you should only get those plans if you were planning on getting that stuff anyway, right? The stuff that you're
Yeah.
already gonna that
Yeah.
they're giving the rewards for buying. As a,
I
at least
mean,
as a consumer, that's what you should be doing.
what it all boils down to is the psychology of like prizes, basically, right? Or people thinking that they're getting a deal. So the math doesn't have to make any sense whatsoever from a consumer perspective. If you feel like you're being given preferential treatment or receiving something of value that's more than what you paid for, it's like, ooh, you know, you get that little buzz from being such a good shopper bee.
Right.
But so those were all just kind of observations about the example you gave. To the question of why is it hard to say no, what I was actually thinking about is, have you ever taken improv classes, or are you familiar with improv classes at all?
I remember when I was in middle school, we had like a theater class or something where we did a stint of improv. I hated it. I'm not good at it. I am not good at thinking on my feet. I will say that loud
Says
and
the
proud.
guy who talks about random topics with no preparation every other week.
Well, that's just me rambling. I'm talking about like you need to be on the ball. You need to come up with the answer on the spot. Like there's no answer to what we're doing. We're just
Yes, there's no
speculating.
answer to improv either. You just gotta find a way to make it funny.
Yeah, but see, that's the thing, right? There's a goal. There's no goal to tangential banter. I'm just
Sure.
letting the thoughts flow. But improv, right? You have to be, I mean, assuming it's a comedy improv, which I guess is the vast majority, like The Office, right? You need to be on the ball as far as making something funny for the audience. Otherwise, they're going to can you.
The early worm gets the worm.
I wouldn't say I'm superstitious, but. But I am a little stitious.
There's a whole like YouTube video of just Michael Scott's malapropisms of when he's trying to make a joke or use a common phrase, turn a phrase, and completely butchers it. But
well, 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 how the turntables. I love
it's
that
like
one.
In almost. Oh yeah.
You could tell he knows he said something like he didn't say it right, because he kind of. It sounds like he.
Off.
Yeah, he. It sounds like he pauses mid sentence. Yeah, mid sentence, but he just owns it. He puts the ball on their court. What are you going to do about it?
Which is great, because he also that he has that line where he's, you know, in an interview and he says, you know, sometimes I'll start a sentence without knowing where it's going, and I just hope I catch up before I reach the end, basically.
Yeah.
And then you see that demonstrated over and over and over again with his little attempts at humor. It also reminded me of is it Almost Famous, where
which Almost
Chris
Famous?
Farley.
Oh, the Chris Farley one. Okay.
Chris Farley and who's with him? Is it David Spade?
No, Luke Perry, I think. Right?
Okay. Or is it yeah, it sounds maybe right. But anyway, it's
Matthew
like
Matthew Perry, maybe?
The old, yes, Matthew Perry.
Okay.
It's like the old Indian saying red sky in the morning.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Like, yes. No, that's it.
What's the full phrase? I know we've discussed this on the podcast before. I think we have, but I can't remember what it is.
The full saying is red sky in the morning, sailors take warning, red sky at night, sailors delight.
Okay.
How did I get on to that?
Something about malapropisms, Michael Scott, how the turn.
Oh, it was improv, though. It was improv.
Ah, so, yes.
I've never taken classes, but one of the things I understand about doing improv, especially with groups, is that they teach you basically not to say no or to contradict the person who precedes you. Because so much of it is like this back and forth, and you're trying to build a story together collectively that wasn't planned in advance. And so basically saying no just completely kills the direction that you're headed in.
Okay.
You know, it's like hard. You can't recover from that, essentially. What got me wondering is if there's any kind of a connection, like a psychological connection, between the reason that people are coached not to say no in improv and why people find it difficult to say no in everyday settings. And going back to your point, I don't know that it's because they think that they would be berated or that the other person's going to keep asking. I think it's just because saying no can make you appear like a jerk, right? It's like we want to be perceived as nice and friendly and willing to help, whatever, right? Like all these things that are beneficial for society. So it's like, well, if someone asks you for something, they must have a reason for it. There must be some need. And so if I'm capable, why wouldn't I say no, right? Like, why would I decline to help this person with whatever their request is? And so I think there's just that general lurking thought that saying no is going to have a negative impact on your relationship with that person specifically, or perhaps over time with your social standing in general.
Yep.
Or your ability to get help from other people in return, right? If I say no to you today, and then I have a need to ask you tomorrow, are you going to turn around and say no because you're, you know,
I would
out
agree
of vengeance
with that.
Or vindictiveness or something?
Yep. I would definitely, particularly at work, I've, you know, at our company, in air quotes, I've...
Potential Banter Incorporated .com.
Limited. I've frequently, like, wanted to say no and thought I should say no, but, like, am afraid to be, like, if I say no, is it going to look like I'm shirking my duties?
Mm-hmm.
Because what your duties are, can be a little fluid, or can be it can be a little fuzzy as to does this fall within my duties or not. And so it's either like I could say yes, and I don't know what I'm getting myself into, or I could say no, but then are they going to get in touch with my boss, and my boss is going to come to me and say, "Why aren't you doing your job?" or something. That's one thing I'm worried about. Now, that doesn't cover all the circumstances, right, of why people would be afraid to say no, because you owe nobody anything when you're at Barnes and Noble and they ask you if you want to be part of a, a rewards program, right? There is no job duties there. But I do 100% agree that, oh, if I say no, I'm going to face consequences. Either because they are going to think less of me, or now I'm, kind of indebted to them because I said no to them. Now they can say no to me. That's a good observation. I would 100% agree with that.
I think,
Or relate just real quick, or related, they may react poorly. Like I would imagine in the sense of, this is one of the many reasons why I don't envy women, because they in general are the party to be asked out on a date by somebody, right? So they are facing the circumstance much more often than dudes are, where somebody whom they don't want to have a relationship with asks them out and they have to say no. Or awkwardly say yes, and then look what they've gotten themselves into. And then, right, if this was somebody who's sort of like a friend already, a friend group or something, that can make it, what happens after that could be awkward. If it's just somebody at a bar who you don't know, is this somebody who's violent and is going to react poorly? I don't know. That's one thing I like about being a dude is I can control just inherent the way our culture works. I get to control that situation a lot more, and I don't have to be worried about being on the defensive.
So what you're saying is when you ask a girl out, you're not worried that she'll say no because of the implication.
Of course she's of course like what it, of course she can say no, but she's not gonna say no because of the implication.
Yet another example of how terrible
It's always me.
Dennis is as a individual. So yeah, I've actually, well, I would argue that both of the sexes in that equation have a burden to bear to some extent because there are a lot of guys out there, like you've got to screw up the courage. And this is assuming good intentions on both parties, right? Obviously, there are people who take advantage of situations, but assuming both people have good intentions, like you've got to screw up your courage, come up with something, trying to catch attention, be interesting, funny, whatever, and then go ask, bracing yourself for the potential rejection, right? So there's that side, and then there's the, yeah, do I find a way to say no, politely say no, or do I awkwardly say yes, or maybe I'm interested and I actually say yes. But I think both sides have a challenging social situation to deal with. But to your point, I actually a few years ago I was in Minneapolis for I'm trying to remember what it was. I've been there twice for different bachelor parties. I don't remember which one it was, but I was on an elevator in the hotel that we were staying at, and it's downtown. I think it's called the W or something like that. And it's like an old kind of skyscraper that's been converted into a hotel, and they have.
Oh, the Fauché building?
Yes. Yeah. It's like the Fauché at the W or vice versa. The W at the. Anyway.
Oh, cool. I didn't know that place was a hotel. That's cool.
At least part of it is. Yeah. So there's like a lounge kind of bar cocktail area on the top floor.
Ooh.
And I was meeting some of the people from my group up there. And so I was riding the elevator up, and when I got in, there were two women in the elevator and some guy. And as we were riding the elevator, this guy just kept pestering the women about like what their plans were for the evening. Like, oh, we're going to the lounge for a drink. And he's like, well, where are you going after that? And they were very, like, obviously uncomfortable answering, kind of being evasive. And he just, like, kept trying to figure out where they were going and what they were going to do. And I was like, basically, by this point in the conversation, we were stopped at our floor and the door opened. Like, as I was walking out, I said, "Whatever their plans are, it sounds like they don't involve you, dude."
Ouch.
Both of the women were like, "Thank you." But that was one of those moments where, to your point, it was like you have no idea. Like the fact that he's not getting the clue makes you kind of uncomfortable already,
Or
right?
maybe he
And
is
then
getting the clue and he doesn't care.
he's ignoring it, yeah.
Yeah.
But you never know when that situation can go sideways, so.
Right. And as a dude, right, we don't necess we very rarely have to worry about being on in that situation. As like, I'm being accosted, and in this case by a chick, and if I say no, I'm worried for my safety, right? That doesn't happen. It,
Right.
I'm sure it does happen. Like I but with, with dudes,
It's
but
the
the sheer,
overwhelming minority.
yes, like women are at a much greater risk of like multiple orders of magnitude of that happening to them.
Which, sidebar on that topic, I've been in several, like, just being aware of that in life in general has changed the way that sometimes I respond in a situation. Like, if I'm walking out of a, say, like a Walmart after dark, and like you're just walking in and out, there's people coming and going or whatever. But if I'm basically within a few steps behind a woman who's alone, I'll just, even if we're both walking directly toward our cars and they happen to be in the same direction, I'll just take a different path so that I'm not walking directly behind her, so that there's less of it. Like, she doesn't feel like she's being followed in any capacity. Or even the one that's annoying is, like, a few years ago, I was driving down the road and I saw someone who was walking alone at, I don't know, it was probably like 11 or something like that, kind of down University Avenue in front of, like, the Gallagher Blue Dorn building in Cedar Falls here. And it was just from the way that she was walking, it was obvious that she was kind of uncomfortable. And I was like, there's that part of me is like, man, there's somebody who doesn't seem comfortable, probably would benefit from having someone make sure they get home okay. But then it's like, you literally can't help, you know what I mean? Because as soon as you offer to help, then you're the predator in that situation. So it's, you're just kind of stuck, like, well, hope that person makes it.
Nothing you could do. I mean, you could risk it, right? Maybe she would have been grateful and no problems, but there's a big chance of she that you would just make her feel scared, more
Right,
scared.
it would reinforce whatever discomfort Charity felt. Yeah, so going back to the work environment, I was going to say, so when you work in a, I'll say, a more straightforward job, like a service type job, for example, where, like, say you're a waiter, right? You're assigned a certain number of tables, so when there's people at your table, you go over, take their orders, make sure they have what they need. There's kind of a defined set of things that you're responsible to do. I feel like when you get into a more complex technical role, or where you don't directly interface with customers who have immediate needs, the job definition becomes a lot more vague. And so you can have a role, like, someone gives you a list of job responsibilities and says, here's what you're supposed to do, whatever. But I think there's always still flexibility in, like, how you do that and what you prioritize, those sorts of things. And I've come to realize over, what, 11 years working full time as an engineer now, that by and large, my supervisor doesn't know specifically what I'm working on unless I tell them. Like, it's not work that's necessarily visible directly to them. And I would also say that I've been given a lot of liberty to kind of massage my job responsibilities as I see fit, to deliver. It's like once I've been in the role and shown that I've known what I'm doing, to be able to essentially say, yeah, this is quote unquote part of the job responsibility, but it's a low value, or it's not something that I'm good at and there's somebody else on the team that can do it. And so anyway, all that to say, I think I've come to believe over the years that saying no is one of the most valuable things an employee can do in their job, because essentially management just keeps asking you to do things. So you can see it as, oh, this is what they told me to do. I have no choice, right? I got to make the boss happy or whatever. But I see it as a, see the need or the intent behind the request. And then based on the expertise that I have, right, the reason that I'm getting a paycheck, I need to analyze that request to understand, is just giving them what they asked for like the best thing in this scenario? Or can I give them something better? Or should I just say, hey, this doesn't fit with my role, or I don't have time or whatever, right? And I think certainly there are bad managers out there who, if you do that, they're going to get upset and steamroll you. But I think by and large, I've had good experiences where when I can explain the reason why I haven't done something that I was asked to, they've generally been on board with it. And like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I would do the same thing. So, but I think there's a lot of people, and it's probably not just in workplace either, where if there's any kind of authority structure, they feel obligated to just go along with what the superior says. And it's like, mm-hmm. I think the opposite. I think it's our responsibility to say no when they're wrong, or when we think they're wrong.
Maybe to say, or at least to challenge them, maybe not outright say, no, I'm not going to do it. But sure. Are you sure? Like, yeah, they should be doing this.
And when I say that, it's not necessarily the word no, but it's, I guess I'd say challenge or pushback, which could amount to no.
And in the job thing, because if somebody asks you to do something and you know that you're really not the guy to do it, but you do it anyway just because you're nice, or you're doing it as a favor, you now, in that person's mind, are the person who did it, because they asked you, hey, can you do this for me? And you said, sure. And then you did it. So they're not going to know any better. That's another reason why it's important to say no. Because if they ask you to do it once, they're going to ask you to do it again and again. And then word will spread and you'll be known as the guy who does that thing that's not actually in your job.
Yeah, that's something I actually had to do very intentionally when I switched job roles, is because I mean, now over like a year and a half later, I still have people coming to me with like, hey, what do you know about this? Or can you help me with this thing? It's like, yeah, that's not my role anymore. And I don't mind helping, but there's actually somebody who does that as their full-time job that you could connect with and they could help you out.
Smart. Yep.
So there's a lot of, it's less like a direct no and more of a redirection to what the person or thing that they actually need.
I know, like the previous role I had before this one was very people centric. Like you're talking to a lot of different people about a lot of different things. So I got a ton of, you know, people contacting me because they didn't know I moved jobs or something. So I'd always occasionally, what I try to do is like answer their question as best I could while copying the new person who has the role on it, and then saying, if you have any more questions, like letting them know, hey, I moved jobs, I'll answer your question now. For all future things, please contact so-and-so. And that's worked out pretty well. I don't think I've gotten any repeats where people just said, okay, and then they came back to me with another question.
What I've done something very similar, but just inverted it a little bit. So I will send an email to I'll forward the email to the person who has the job responsibility now, and I'll copy the person who sent the original email, and I'll say, hey, can you take care of this request for whoever?
Right? Oh, smart. Yeah.
But this may be a little bit less explicit that it's not my role anymore, But I don't know. Seems like it works out, and then I think it maybe shortens the feedback loop to the person who actually needs to take action because they're seeing that, like, oh, someone's asking me to do something.
It's a bit of a, like when you do the, it's almost a bit passive aggressive when somebody asks you, hey, can you do this for me? And then you email somebody else, CC the original person, said, hey, this is your responsibility. You'll turn back to the original requester, wink, wink. Can you take care of this for me? Yeah. Then you look back and you whisper, you stupid idiot.
So you're saying I shouldn't do it that way.
I would definitely, I definitely feel as, because that's happened to me, right? Where I request something to someone and then they pull on me what you just described pulling. And it's always left me feel a little bit like, ooh, like a bit ashamed that I didn't get
So you would prefer to just get the direct response, hey, that's not my job anymore, contact this person? Because I
when you
don't mean
said,
it to be like demeaning. I just want it for efficiency purposes, like, hey, they need something. Here's the person they go to.
so okay, so I think I just in my brain captured why. Because if I go to you, Ben, and say, Ben, I need some help with this. Can you help me? And you just sit there, you stare at me. I know that you got the response, and you immediately turn to somebody else and say, can you take care of Jack, please? And it's just like, wow, okay, Ben. Like, now what I think would be better is, or what would make me feel warmest is if the person directly said, hey, it's not my job anymore. Like saying it just kind of like, matter of fact, say, hey, I moved jobs. So and so backfilled me. So and so, can you please help Jack? That would make me feel okay. So he saw I had the request and he deliberately said, hey, I'm gonna, I'm the buck stops here. I'm gonna let him know this isn't my thing anymore. But then I'm gonna pass him off to the person whose responsibility it is now.
So you're saying combined methods then, where you
Yeah,
address
yes.
both people.
Yes. Because then you're introducing the two, right? So you're at you are I when you do just the passive, well, I'm gonna sort of tongue in cheek call it the passive aggressive method just to kind of give you some grief. It seems like you're just what's the not you but the person who's doing it is just offloading it on somebody else. Like, I don't want to do this, you take care of it. And I know that's not what's happening, but that's sort of
Well, it's
like
kind of
the
what's happening.
air. It well, you're justified in doing it, right? But it's also like you're doing the bare minimum of not my job, so and so, you take this off my hands. What I like about the combined method is you're doing the work of one, making sure that the requester understands, like, hey, I'm not the person who's doing this anymore, but let me introduce you to who can, and let me kind of introduce your question to them. So I'm doing
Yeah.
as much as I can to connect you to the right person. And then may, often I'll sometimes say, can you help so and so with this thing? And then give them some details that might be helpful for them. Because if they're new, they're backfilling me, I have some more experience in it, so maybe I can give them a head start. And then that shows that I'm not completely dumping this on somebody new. I'm trying to do my thing, but I'm also trying to go back into go to my new role that I'm responsible for now.
Yeah, I've definitely done that in some instances where I've been backfilled on the responsibility, but the way that the initial request is worded maybe doesn't give the person all the information that they need, or the new person may not be able to deduce what they should from the message. And so I kind of have introduced the topic or the request, and then paraphrased what my understanding of what needs to happen is as a next step to kind of
Yeah.
draw that out a little bit.
So,
So
why do people hate to say no? Where do we go with that topic?
I think in general, like we talked about cases where we perceive that saying no may lead to something that's like immediately bad for our physical safety, or where saying no is going to have a negative impact on how we're perceived by that individual or by the organization. Or because it may lead to our, payback kind of thing where people don't do things for us when we need help.
So my advice to people in that case is to, if you're afraid of confrontation, and I don't mean like you're fearful for your safety, right? If some sketchy dude starts hitting on you as a chick, and you're not sure what this guy's going to do if you flat out reject him, that's not what I'm talking about. Do whatever you have to stay safe. But what I am talking about is, it's something at work or the Barnes and Noble situation, right? My iteration of what happened is me implementing what I'm about to say. Make it awkward for them to confront you. Because when he said, like, because you're worried, right, about making things awkward or, guys getting confrontational and you're going to, oh, okay, maybe I'll just back down and say yes. But no, I'm going to stand my ground. If you want to make this awkward, it ain't going to be, or excuse me, if this exchange gets awkward, it ain't going to be because of me. It's going to be because of you. So that's why when I went to Barnes and Noble, I was like, are you part of the rewards program? No. Do you want to be a part of one or a part of it? Like, no, thank you. It's like, are you sure? Like, you'll save money. Yes. And I just stared at him. He says, you're turning down free money? And I just said, yes. And I kept eye contact with him. Just blank face, just staring right at him. And it's like, what are you going to do now? And then he just said, okay. And then just went back to ringing me up. And I said in my head, that's what I thought. You leave me alone. If I don't want to be a part of your rewards program, then quit badgering me.
Or the other alternative is that you just really draw it out like you're super interested and then you just walk away. Like, oh, what does that include? What sort of rewards do I get? Are you a member? How long have you been a member? What's your experience been like? And then you just bounce, like right while they're mid-sentence.
As you're asking a question like, oh, what do I have to do to sign up to that as you walk out the door?
Or the from Happy Gilmore is like, oh yeah, sure, 7 to 7.
Oh, that's right.
Just give him the old thumbs down with the raspberry noise. I feel like, yeah, to some extent too, you're how comfortable you are making like, confronting someone, or not even confronting, but just countering the request, whether that's no or redirect or whatever, depends on your level of comfort with that person and how much risk you feel like you have of endangering the future of that relationship. So it's easy with a clerk or something to be fairly bold and direct, whereas you may take a totally different approach with a friend or a neighbor or somebody where how you handle the situation is going to directly impact you in the future.
Yep, I would agree. I still would argue for the just be don't beat around the bush. Like just come out
Sure.
and say no for one thing, 'cause you don't want to indicate that you feel guilty for turning them down. 'Cause if you do, then the requester is going to know that you feel guilty because you know that you should be doing it and they will latch on to that.
Okay, real quick, a thought on that. A few years ago, I was reading some books about psychology, and they were talking about the psychology of making requests. And they talked about how if you make a request, like the study that they did was with people, they had people waiting in line for to use a copier, or like they gave them a task to copy something, and then there was only one copier, and there were a bunch of people. And then they basically started evaluating the effect that requests had on people and then excuses for the request. So what they found was that if someone in the back of the line just said, "Hey, can I go next to use the copier," basically to cut the line, they would never get agreement from anybody to do that. It's like, "No, wait your turn." But if you said, "Hey, can I go next?" and then gave a reason, the likelihood of you getting agreement to your request increased by, I don't remember, it was a very large number. But the crazy part of that finding was it wasn't just like your excuse didn't even have to make sense. So it's not like, hey, can I go next because I really have to go to the bathroom or something like that. Like that would kind of make sense, like, oh, let him get his copies done so he can go to the bathroom. You could just literally say something like, hey, can I go next because I want to, or like because I have to make copies. And it didn't have to be a plausible excuse. You just had to list a reason. And it immediately increased, like, a statistically significant amount how willing people were to grant your request.
This sounds
So
familiar. We may have brought this up on the podcast
it's
before.
possible. It's possible. So I was just thinking, if you reverse that, when somebody asks you to do something, you could probably soften the blow by just giving a reason, right? Like, we love to give excuses. Just be like,
Right.
oh, could you help me walk my dog or whatever? Like, oh, sorry, I don't want to.
Yep. But honestly, right? If
Instead
you
of
just
just saying no, they're like, oh, well, okay, that makes sense.
maybe I'll try that. Like, and it would probably have to be someone like you or like a close friend say, hey, can you do this for me? And you just say, oh, no, sorry, I just really don't want to. And just leave it at that. And then leave the ball in their court. Don't explain yourself. Don't look guilty. Don't sound guilty. So even I said, I'm sorry, right? But that was a bit more of the generic type.
Yeah.
But if you just, Ben, if you're like, hey, can you like come over and watch Sadie for me tomorrow? And I just said, oh, no, I don't want to. Because now it's like, now you have to respond. So now, and this is what I was talking about making it awkward. Because you know now that I have no intention of doing it. You even know why. You know why that I don't want to, for one. And now you either have to, the ball's in your court. You have a decision to make. You either accept it, or now you have to start pleading with me. And you have to start either trying to guilt trip me, or begging isn't the right word, but trying to negotiate with me. And now your power in the conversation is considerably lower. Whereas if I had been feeling guilty, you can now say, well, why don't you want to help me? Like, what are you trying to do? Like, you can you have that leverage on them. But if you just come out boldly and say, nope, I don't want to do that, and that's all you do, that's all you say. You don't ramble on, you don't mumble on. Now it's up to them to say, okay, I could try to guilt trip this guy, but I don't know, that's going to put me in an awkward situation.
I was just thinking as you were saying that, like, what are some, it would be kind of funny to just come up with an implausible but absolute reason why you couldn't, for example, join a rewards program that every time you're asked, you just say it, like, I gotta drive, or my wife won't allow it, or I believe rewards programs are unethical, or something like that, you know?
I was gonna
Just
say
something that really, like, twists your brain a little bit.
at the Barnes and Noble, say, hey, I'd like to get these books, please. Oh, okay, sure, I'll ring this up. Are you part of a rewards program? I'm not. Oh, would you like to be? Oh, no, sorry, I can't read.
Yeah, that'd be a good one. Or at a gas station, you could be like, oh, no, I've got an electric car.
Or I don't drive.
Yeah. I feel like I'm now gonna think of something like that.
Or another thing that I can't believe I didn't bring this up before, because this is I don't really have the opportunity to try this out very often. But just to literally give nonsensical answers. Like, can I ring you up? Yeah, sure. Are you part of a rewards program? No. Do you want to be? Maybe later? No, that actually makes sense. But it's just like, are you sure you don't want to be part of a rewards program? That's a yes or no question. You know what? I'm doing a really bad job representing this idea of mine. Let's move past it. If something comes up, I'll reiterate the point.
You could just say something like cheese and crackers or Barnabas.
Well, I was thinking more along the lines of it's like you misunderstood what they said.
Oh, just say, I'm good, thanks.
Yeah, it's
Or
like, would you like
no.
to be part of a rewards program? Oh, thanks, man. Oh, so you do want to be. Oh, I'd guess about 5 o'clock.
There you go.
And you just do that often enough until they just give up.
Yeah, do you want to be part of our rewards program? I think it's 345. What?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't understand. Can you say that again? Would you like to be part of our rewards program? One more time. Would you like to be a part of our rewards program? I can't quite understand what you're saying. Can you please repeat it one more time?
What is a rewards program?
Rewards program. I don't know what that is. What is that? But then, no, you don't want to do that, Ben, because then they're going to go in the long sales pitch.
That reminds me of when we were in China and we were in a kind of touristy area, and there was this group of kids who were like running around. I'll use the word accosting. They weren't like, they were just kind of stopping tourists and trying to sell them stuff. And I may have told this story before, but they came up, and I mean, I'm white, so I think it was a fairly safe bet to ask something in English. And I can't remember what they said as an introduction, if it was just hi or something, but I responded in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And the look of surprise on their face was like priceless, but they all like ran away. And a few seconds later, this one of the kids comes back and like introduces himself in Spanish. And then I responded in German.
Oh no.
And he looked super confused. And then I can't remember. I don't think anybody else came back after that. But I was like, dang. So they're prepared for like non-English speaking tourists. But yeah, it was like, I'm just going to keep cycling through until I find a language they're not prepared for, you know, at least of the ones where I can say a few words. But I was just thinking of the kid who was like, oh yeah, that guy there, he speaks Spanish. Go over and talk to him. And he's introduces himself and it gets German in response.
I've always wanted to learn like Polish because I guess Russian or any other Eastern European language would do, but I'm Polish, so that's why I'd want to learn that one specifically. But anyway, because Polish or all those Eastern European dialects do not sound very friendly. Maybe not as belligerent as German, but still, like, if you go up and you start accosting someone and say, hey, you want to buy this? And you just turn and you just immediately start, not like yelling, but like very in a very annoyed, kind of angry voice, just start spouting off Polish as fast as you can. Just this weird gibberish that this guy can't understand. He understands that you're angry. He understands that you're foreign. He doesn't want to do anything or be anything associated with you. He's going to back off.
So you just say like, Nazdravia, pierogi.
Yeah.
Krakow.
It's Krakow in Polish, by the way.
Yeah, that's how they'll correct me. If they can correct me, then the gig's already out.
Yeah.
So now you know how to avoid street salespeople. Just keep jumping between whatever languages you know. They'll never catch on.
Yep.
All right. Well, I know you've got to get going, and we are past the time where we plan to end. So,
are we? Oh wow, we are. I'm not. I was going to take him for a walk, and then he wanted the window, and I felt like the air coming in from outside. I was like, that is hot and humid. And I checked the weather report, and it wasn't as cloudy nor as cool as it was supposed to. So I just said, screw it.
Oh, poor Milo. No walk today.
Not today. He had walks the last 3 days. I'll give him a walk tomorrow and Sunday. He's good. I find if I take him for walks too frequently, he begins to not like them. So a day off is not bad. Isn't gotcha. That right, buddy? My little pooper.
Yep. You're a little pooper.
My little pooper. He's my little big blind 17-pound tiger.
It's got to go to the little cat's room.
Yep.
All right. Well, I think that brings us to an end for today. So thanks for hanging out with us. And as always, if you would like to join us as a guest in a future episode, you can just click the link in the episode description or on our, I don't know what you call it, bio page. So you can sign up through our Google Forms there or just contribute a topic. If there's something that you have on your mind you'd like to hear us talk about, we always welcome those suggestions. So until next time, take care.